Well, these are unusual times that we're facing here lately. This is a very different way of our studying together than what we usually do. But I hope that something can be said that will be helpful to us. I know that a number of us would have already thought a great deal about the recent events in this country that have made efforts like this necessary. And I hope that we can put aside the different way of receiving this information as well as of giving it and profit from it. And I would like to spend this time speaking to you concerning David's three giants. And I'll be studying primarily with you from 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 17, of course, is a very famous chapter because it records David's most famous battle, I suppose, that he ever fought. And he fought it with a Goliath. Goliath is David's most famous giant. We don't hear about the other two very much. We're talking about David's three giants, but we know quite a bit about Goliath. Interestingly, this text in 1 Samuel 17 never calls Goliath a giant. That word is not used here. Now, we don't have any doubt that he is one because verse 4 tells us his stature, and that speaks for itself. Let's read the first four verses of 1 Samuel 17. Now, the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Socoh and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. If you have a 21-inch cubit, which is about normal, I believe, that would make him around 9 feet 9 inches tall. I call that a giant. It tells us in verse 5 he wore a bronze helmet. He had a coat of mail. Mail means scale armor, not that he was a delivery man. And it says the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. So he was wearing about 125 pounds of clothing and armor. He had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. That's about the weight of a bowling ball. Imagine being strong enough you could throw a stick with a bowling ball on the end of it and do some harm to an enemy. And a shield bearer went before him. Now that goes all the way through verse 7. In verse 8, he issues his challenge. He's challenging the armies of Israel. He feels invincible, and he has been able to come to a solution to regular warfare where all people get killed on both sides or many casualties and injuries. We can have a representative battle, he thinks, where one person from each side goes out and the winner wins all. And so he says, you choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. Come down off your mountain into this valley, and I'll come down off our mountain into this valley. And if he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. Well, the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. So he's not only making the challenge, but he's throwing in a little bit of an abrasive braggadocio with it. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed, and they were greatly afraid. Somebody has said, this is no time to panic. Well, they thought this was the perfect time to panic. And it then introduces, right out of the blue, David, the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. David had been introduced in chapter 16, and we hope to see more about him in just a moment. This Jesse had 8 sons, and the man was old, and he was advanced in years in the days of Saul, and his 3 oldest sons had gone to follow Saul to the battle. They were here this day, apparently. There's Eliab, the firstborn, and then Abinadab, and then Shammah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. He's a shepherd, not a soldier. He's more or less a young boy, not a grown fighting man. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. So 80 times he's challenged Israel. And not only has there not been a single person in the army of Israel to go out and say, I accept this challenge. On the contrary, they're too afraid even to answer him or to challenge him. So verse 17, Jesse says to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp. So his father orders him to the camp. He tells him to carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, see how your brothers are doing, and then bring back news. Well, Saul and the men of Israel were in the Valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. That's the place where the battle was supposed to be going on. David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and he took the things and went as his father had told him. And he came to the camp and he was going to the fight and shouting. The army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. And we wondered at this point, what fight? They're not accepting the challenge of Goliath. For Goliath was among these Philistines. And you had all these Israelites who have not paid him any attention to accept his challenge. Verse 21 says, for Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper. He ran to the army and he came and greeted his brothers. And as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke those words and David heard them. So David, he is here at the right place at the right time to hear this challenge of this unbeliever. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? He's come up to defy Israel. And the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. The richness of that offer incidentally shows the desperation of King Saul to get someone to meet this giant. So David spoke to the men and he said, let me get some clarification here. And he has them repeat it. In verse 28, at this point, Eliab hears what David is saying to these men. And his anger was aroused against David. And he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? That's a gold-plated insult. You don't belong here. You're just a boy taking care of a few sheep out in the pasture. And then he says, I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. So David is a show-off, and David is the one who needs to go home, when in fact, Eliab and the others haven't done anything worthy of being a soldier. They're the ones who need to go home if they're not going to fight. In verse 29, David said, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? So he turns from him, and he said the same thing, and they answered him the same way. And that came to the ears of Saul. But I find it interesting that when David takes seriously this challenge, he's apparently amazed that no one has accepted it for these 80 times it's been offered. He goes to Saul. Saul tells him, you can't do this, and finally sends him on. And then when he comes to the place of the meeting with Goliath, it's apparent that as David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine, the other men in Israel had run away from this man. David runs toward him, verse 48 says. David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over him. And it tells us he also struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Verse 51 says David ran. He ran to meet him, verse 48. Now he runs to finish him off in verse 51. He ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with that sword. When the Philistine saw this, I can't imagine what was going through their minds. This was not what they expected. And that's an understatement. But they fled. It's now time for them to run. And the children of Israel are chasing them, verse 53 tells us. That's the most famous giant. And the text pretty well speaks for itself, showing the great courage of David and the death of this Goliath, because David's trust was in the Lord. In verse 47, David's point was this: all of his assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. He says that to Goliath, and of course Goliath doesn't believe it. And of course the children of Israel didn't believe it any more than Goliath did. David alone believed those words, but he meant every one of them, and God would be the one to deliver both him and the army of Israel. That's the first giant that David takes on. Now the second one is another man who's very, very tall. In fact, when he stood up, he was taller than all the men of Israel. And that's King Saul himself. He's the giant of Israel. And if anyone should have taken on Goliath in this battle, it should have been Israel's representative giant, King Saul. Saul was a long-term giant in more ways than just his physical stature, however. You'll notice in chapter 17, verse 33, Saul says to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." Saul looks at his age, his size, and his inexperience, and Saul offers him nothing but unbelief and discouragement. "You cannot do this. Who do you think you are to take on this giant?" This is an unbeliever in Israel, and that unbeliever is the king. This king did not believe that David, under the power of God, could take this giant away. Furthermore, in verse 38 of this same chapter, Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head. He also clothed him with a coat of mail, so he would dress him up as Goliath was dressed. David's a little runt compared to Goliath, but at least he'll have some armor. Maybe he'll have a few seconds before Goliath smashes him. But the fact of it is, Saul is giving him worldly advice. We've already mentioned in verse 33, Saul is an unbeliever. He doesn't believe God can do this through David. And now he shows that unbelievers rely on things, not God who gives us those things. Unbelievers rely upon armor or other weapons, when in fact the power here will come from God. David knew that, but Saul, as far as I can tell, throughout his life, never grasped that one essential quality he needed to lead Israel. And then the third part of Saul being a great giant who could have undone David shows his envy in chapter 18. We have an occasion in verses 6 and 7 of 1 Samuel 18 where the women are singing a song of victory. And they go out to meet King Saul with this new number one hit they're singing. And as they sang, they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. You couldn't ask for a more desperate situation in Saul's heart than this. It's as though they've stabbed him in his heart. It tells us in verse 8, Saul was very angry. Now, what does he have to be angry about? His greatest threat is gone. Goliath is dead. He should be the happiest man in the world. But he can't see beyond the fact that now he is second fiddle and David is the first man in the kingdom. David's getting the praise that Saul used to get, and Saul cannot stand it. He's envious of David because David lived by faith And that faith in the power of God had rescued Israel from this horrible enemy, something Saul could never have accomplished because he's an unbeliever. Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" Verse 9 says it all. So Saul eyed David from that day forward. Envy raised its ugly head at this point. So Saul, this man of unbelief, this man of worldly advice, this man who is envious of David, is a great threat to David for the rest of Saul's life, which will be several years. But David manages to conquer because of his trust in God once again. So the number one giant, that's Goliath. Number two is Saul. But in my opinion, there's another giant that could have undone David in a way that these other two could not have. This one may be, in reality, David's biggest giant. And he happens to be David's brother, Eliab, who is described here in chapter 17, verse 28, speaking to David in very, very harsh terms. In fact, he shows many of the same traits at this point that King Saul himself had been showing. Now, this is a brother who can teach us a lot. We're told in Romans 15:4 that the things that were written before time were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. We can learn from these. We can learn from David and from these giants, particularly this third one in this particular lesson. So let's talk about the brother with heart problems. That's Eliab. But to introduce him, we have to go back first to chapter 16 again. In chapter 16, you know that Saul has been rejected, and that would be in chapter 15, which we will not go into at this point. Saul has been rejected as king. And so the Lord tells Samuel that he must go and provide himself a king among the sons of Jesse. That's in 16, verse 1. Samuel protests that Saul may find out about this and kill him, because Saul would be very envious if someone tried to take his place. We've just seen that in chapter 18, his reaction to David. And he tells him, you go and you offer a sacrifice, and then he went and he consecrated Jesse and his sons, invited them to the sacrifice. And in verse 6, 16:6, so it was when they came that he looked at Eliab and he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. This is it. This must be the one. But in verse 7, look at what the Lord said. The Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature. Eliab must have been a fine-looking man. He must have looked like a really good soldier. He must have looked as if he would make a very good king. And Samuel immediately concluded, well, this must be the one. If Samuel were choosing him, that's who he would choose. But God says, I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Eliab is rejected. He's passed over from being king. It implies that if the Lord looks at the heart and he rejects Eliab, he doesn't have the kind of heart God wants. Who will he choose? Well, all of his sons passed before him, and none of them were chosen. And in verse 11, Samuel said, are all the young men here? And he said, well, there remains yet the youngest. They hadn't even brought him. He's not even a part of their consideration. And he said, there he is keeping the sheep. What are his qualifications for being a king? Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here. So he sent and brought him. And he was ruddy, with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. Now, if this had been in a classroom, he would have been voted least likely to succeed. There is not much in David to make one think, well, there would make a great king. No, that would be Eliab. But the Lord knows the heart. And David's heart was what it should be. Eliab's heart was not what it should be. And you can see that in chapter 17, verse 28, when he tries to tear David to pieces. Eliab is sick on sour grapes. So in chapter 17, at the time when David shows up, there's even more severe irritation. Little brother not only has been chosen instead of Eliab to be the king, he's been anointed the next king, but little brother now outdoes him on the battlefield. The battlefield is Eliab's bailiwick. That's his specialty. That's where he shines. But for David to come along and beat this giant is like ripping a Band-Aid off a very sore place on a person's body. It hurts. Eliab is already smarting over this king selection. But Eliab didn't do what David did. He didn't go out and face Goliath, and now he lashes out. He's embarrassed. Eliab is the soldier. He's the oldest brother. He had the look of a king. David is a shepherd boy. He's a little brother. He's the youngest. He's the novice. Eliab's actions imply some very serious symptoms. Let me run through some of these. You would get the impression from looking at verse 28 in chapter 17 that Eliab is filled with jealousy and envy. David is an instant celebrity. What does Saul do when David becomes an instant celebrity? He eyes him from that day forth. You get the same impression with Eliab here. Now, when you talk about jealousy, jealousy says, I deserve praise too. If David is getting praise, give me praise too and we'll be all right. That's jealousy. Envy goes beyond that. Envy is even uglier. Envy says, I deserve praise, but not David. He shouldn't even be here. But rather than define these terms of jealousy and envy, we can see all we need to see by considering some examples. For example, Saul in chapter 18, the green-eyed monster devoured Saul. You know how Saul lost everything? He was eaten by the green-eyed monster of envy. It consumed him for the rest of his life. Cain in Genesis 4 was hurt. He was embarrassed. He was envious because his brother Abel had been praised for his worship in Genesis 4. Cain had not been praised, and he killed his brother. That's not just jealousy. That's envy. That's what envy is capable of doing. Joseph's brothers in Genesis 37 hated Joseph so much they wanted to kill him. Joab murdered Abner, 2 Samuel 3. He was a rival to Joab to take away his place as the general of David's army. Later in 2 Samuel 20, he kills Amasa. Joab would brook no rivals. Anybody who is his competitor must be put out of the way. It's not, yes, you can serve with me. It has to be me and not you. That's envy. In Matthew 2:16, then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry. And he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts, from 2 years old and under. Imagine being so envious of a baby that was called the king that he kills these male children, not just in the city of Bethlehem, but in all the districts around. We also know that the older brother in Luke 15 was envious of his brother. When the prodigal returned home, this older brother wouldn't even go in. He resented the attention that his father would show to this younger brother. The facts are that the older brother was in worse condition than the younger one, though he had an air of respectability and piety about him. He was a hypocrite. He was envious. The Jewish leaders in Matthew 27:18 were envious, and even Pilate could see it. Matthew 27:18 shows that Pilate knew they brought him up because of envy. Here's a pagan governor with more spiritual insight than the Jewish religious leaders had. The Jews in Acts 13 were upset because on the next Sabbath at Antioch, when the whole city came together to hear the word of God, the Jews saw the multitudes and were filled with envy. What'd they do? They contradicted and blasphemed, and they opposed the things spoken by Paul. That's some way for people to come to an assembly, isn't it? Not only must we talk about Eliab's jealousy and envy, there seems to be quite a bit of pride associated with his character as well. Pride is a close kin to jealousy and envy. A wounded pride nurses grudges and it hurls hatred. When you talk about pride, you're talking about me. It's all about me. Focus on me. Reward me. Exalt me. It's all me, me, me. And then another thing about Eliab, there's fear. He was afraid of Goliath. I believe he feared public opinion even more. Little brother is now a hero, but what is he? He's a coward. He had run when Goliath showed up. Fear in this context will make a person do some pretty abominable things. Namely, pull the hero down to your level or below. And then there's assumption. He claims to know David's heart. In verse 28, he says, I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. How does he know? Can he read David's mind? What he does is reveal his own heart. He assumes the worst about David because that's how he would act if he were David. He judges David harshly. He is unkind, he's unjust, and he's unfair. In situations like this, Matthew 7:1 applies. Judge not, that you be not judged. Because with the kind of judgment you judge someone else, you're going to be judged, verse 2 says. He's shamed by David's heroism. His faith is not as strong as his little brother's. He ran from the enemy, remember? In verse 24, as Goliath talked, the people in Israel fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. Do you know that includes Eliab? He did what David didn't dare do. He didn't run from Goliath. He ran to him. Eliab is also a discourager. He scolds David to put him in his place. He would prefer a living Goliath to a heroic David. And that becomes very clear in this context. Also, his anger. We're told that Eliab's anger was aroused against David, verse 28. Eliab is the one in danger. There's only one letter's difference in the word anger and the word danger. Take the word anger and put the D on the beginning of it and you have danger. Eliab is in great danger. There is a waste of energy and emotion. What if Eliab, instead of getting so upset over David, what if 40 days prior to this, he had been so upset over what Goliath had said? So upset, in fact, that he was determined to go out and meet him on the battlefield and do what David did. But no, he doesn't do that. Eliab is embarrassed. He's the firstborn. He possessed authority by priority, and his youngest brother has shown him up. But I think worst of all, showing at once how unnecessary Eliab's little fit was and what could have been done by him had he been the right kind of person, he is outdone by Saul's own son, Jonathan. In 1 Samuel 18, at verse 1, when Saul had finished speaking with David, we're told, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Jonathan is the very opposite of his father. This actually reveals another giant. If you want to talk about giants, this is one that didn't oppose David, but actually helped him. If any person in Israel had a reason to despise David, it was Jonathan. Jonathan instead shows one of the most exemplary attitudes we'll find anywhere. Jonathan was the firstborn son of the king. David was the lastborn son of a farmer. Jonathan was the crown prince. Everybody expected him to replace Saul. Nobody expected David to replace Saul. He's a boy shepherding sheep. And yet Jonathan loves him as his own soul. He would no more hurt David than he would hurt himself. Their love for God and for each other excluded the possibility of rivalry. In chapter 23 of 1 Samuel, David is staying in strongholds because Saul sought him every day, verse 14 tells us. And in verse 16, then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. Instead of Jonathan encouraging his father, if you keep looking here or there, you might find David and put him out of his misery, put him out of my misery, get rid of him because I want to be king. No. He went and strengthened David's hand in God. And he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. And David stayed in the woods, and Jonathan went to his own house. This is one of the most remarkable events in all Scripture. Love absolutely destroyed the possibility of envy. Jonathan's amazing last words to David are not only free of rivalry, but full of desire to serve God and to serve David as king. Jonathan gladly promises David he will serve as his second-hand man. How could Saul have raised such a son as Jonathan? But when you look at this son with this magnanimous heart, with this great love for a man that should be loved for what he's done, David, when you look at him, you wonder, why couldn't Eliab have shown half this much love and gratitude for his own little brother? Pretty amazing, isn't it? So now we've spent a little bit of time talking about the brother with heart problems. That's Eliab. Let's spend the few minutes that remain talking about the brother with humility. Looking over this text, would you have a clue as to which brother with humility I might have in my mind? I refer to Eliab. Somebody says, oh, you've lost your mind. You said Eliab. Eliab is the brother with heart problems. Yes, that's true. But follow me on this. In chapter 17, at verse 22, when David arrives at the place where he's going to fight the giant, it says he ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. Now that includes Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah and all the others, these three at least that are there with them. But Eliab is certainly part of that. He greeted his brothers. Now, in 17:22, greeted his brothers, those same words occur in chapter 22 at verse 1. In 22:1, we're told, David therefore departed from there. This is while he is a refugee running from Saul from place to place. He departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. His brothers? Yes. You mean even Eliab? Yes. His brothers and all his father's house includes Eliab. In fact, in verse 2, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, so he became captain over them. And there were about 400 men with him. And David took pains to see to it that his own parents were sent to Moab, but his brothers and all these others are with David. And so what do we see here? When lives are at stake, you have a common enemy, Saul. It's pretty easy to reconcile. We need one another. Eliab needs David. And spiritually speaking, this is true. We all face the same devil, the same Satan. He's after all of us. And we should help one another. We need the help of one another. So though Eliab had mistreated David, David is willing to forget it totally. He embraces his father. He embraces his brothers. When Eliab came down, he went down to be a part of David's troop, of which David was the captain. Both of them became Saul's enemies. chapter 22, at verse 6, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. Then he goes on to talk about what he's going to do. It turns out that Saul does some pretty amazingly evil things at this point. The old statement at the time of the Revolutionary War, when Congress had come together and they're working on the Constitution, I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "We must hang together or we will all hang separately." David and Eliab must have reconciled. And that is, in fact, what the Scriptures teach us. If you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Matthew 5, 23 and 24. Eliab has changed. He's become a bigger person. Did he admit he was wrong and confess to David he had said some harsh things? I don't know. Did he admit his little brother was right? I don't know. That's a rare thing. But his coming to David is also a rare thing, so I would not doubt that possibility. I do know he put the common good of the nation over his petty anger at David. Eliab finally conquered his giants. And he became the brother with humility. It takes humility to make confessions such as these. Now, some lessons from this. We too, just as Eliab did, can change. We can repent. We can resist temptation. No temptation has overtaken us except as is common to man. God will not let us be tempted above what we're able, but with the temptation, he'll make a way of escape that we may be able to bear. To paraphrase of 1 Corinthians 10, 13. Number two, we can love our brothers even if they appear as a competitor to us. In Genesis 44, Judah changed his view toward Joseph. Jonathan had an excellent view toward David. Number three, we can consider others more important than ourselves. That's what the Scriptures teach. Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, as Eliab had earlier done. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. That would have caused Eliab a lot of embarrassing trouble. Number four, giants can make or break God's people. In Numbers 13, there we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. Numbers 13:33. 10 unbelieving spies feared the giants instead of God. 2 believers feared God instead of the giants. On a smaller scale, David believed God instead of the giant Goliath. Giants can make or break God's people then and now. And then number 5, God can use the most unlikely people to win his victories. David is the youngest brother, not even a soldier, and yet he conquered Goliath. Saul of Tarsus is one of the most unlikely converts in the history of the New Testament teaching. And yet, he becomes the Apostle Paul. Who would have thought such a conversion was possible? Number 6, we can live in hope and encourage even when giants threaten us. God is still bigger than any Goliath. Just a short time before he was to be put to death, Paul says, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8. Number 7, David overcame by his real armor. And that armor was faith. Hebrews 11, 32. What more can I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, and Samson, and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. We have a shield of faith. Ephesians 6:16, above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Satan is bigger than Goliath, but our Lord is bigger than he is. And he has equipped us with armor that is the same armor David had, the armor of faith. And it can overcome any enemy that we meet. And then number 8, David defeated Goliath, but sadly, he later let down his guard and he fell at the feet of a woman who brought him untold disaster. And the lesson here is don't give up the fight till it's over. You may conquer Goliath today, but if you're not careful, you can fall to a smaller foe tomorrow. All of us face giants. They come with different names. It may be envy. It could be sickness. It could be family problems. It could be fear. It could be viruses. It could be death. All of us can handle trials in our way, as Saul would have done, or in God's way, as David did. One thing we know, faith is the victory. 1 John 5, for whatever is born of God overcomes the world. Notice, it doesn't just overcome Goliath, it overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. We live in times when some people are very scared. Some people are wringing their hands in despair. They don't know where to turn. But Christians know exactly where to turn. Christians know exactly where to place their faith, their trust, and their hope. And we all realize that when this world and the evil things and the painful things of this world have done all that they can do, God is still in control. And God can bless us beyond our ability even to comprehend. Think on these things. Thank you so much for listening, and may God bless you all.